Today on the Wet Fly Swing podcast, we've got Brownie Lyles on to take us into East Tennessee and drift boat building. Brownie has 25 years as a guide in two famous rivers out in this part of East Tennessee. He has a super unique drift boat skiff that he's building, and he has a lodge on the river. Today, Brownie describes how his plastic drift boat skiff is unique and why he created a high-sided skiff. If you're going to be around East Tennessee, you need to check in with Brownie and Blue Ridge Boatworks. Brownie talks about some of the best guides in the area, some tips on catching fish here, and some of the best food to be checking out if you're in town. We also find out about the amazing caddis hatch they have that you don't want to miss. So let's find out more about the Watauga River and fishing East Tennessee on the fly. Here we go. Brownie Lyles from BlueRidgeBoatworks.com. How you doing, Brownie?
Great. I'm glad to be here with you, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for making a little time today to jump into this. We're going to be, you're in a cool part of the country, you know, Tennessee, East Tennessee. We hear a lot about it. There's a couple of famous rivers in your area we're going to talk about. You've also got a boat company, Blue Ridge Boatworks, and we had a whole drift boat season on, and it was awesome. I talked to a number of companies, a couple on the eastern United States, but mostly out west. And so this is going to be a continuation of that. I'll put a link in the show notes to that series that we had. And so we're going to talk about your boat company, how that came to be and everything there. But before we jump into everything and give some people some tips on fishing and boats, talk about how you first got into fly fishing and kind of what's your first memory.
Let's see. It was a long time ago, probably 1995. I was in the whitewater kayaking business and did that for a living, and actually moved to the mountains of North Carolina to start a kayak school. My sister gave me a fly rod for Christmas, and I became obsessed with it. And that usually, whatever, there's lots of paths that I can take, but that led me to, I want to be a guide. And so my whole career kind of morphed at 30, and I started fishing.
Mm. What river were you guiding when you started?
So I was on the Toe River, which is a fairly remote spot in western North Carolina. It's the headwaters of the Nolichucky River, which is a little bit more famous whitewater river, smallmouth fishery as well. And I saw a float boat coming down the river one day, and that got my mind clicking about what I was doing, and pretty much just gave up the kayak business for the fishing business.
And what's a float boat?
Oh, sorry. It was a raft back in that day.
Oh, a raft.
Yeah. Sorry. There were certainly no hard boats around here back then, but there was some guys floating down the river in a raft with a fishing frame, fishing for smallmouth.
Gotcha. Yeah. Fishing for smallmouth. That's awesome. Yeah. And we've done a couple of episodes recently on smallmouth, and you know, that conversation talked about how there were really no boats. And then this person talked about how, yeah, he started fishing boats and now you're seeing more. Is that, what's it look like now? Do you see a lot more rafts and drift boats in that home water?
Yeah, it really blew up here. And understandably, it's good fishing. There's a lot of water, tons of rivers, and certainly a whole bunch of folks not too far away as a client base. But yeah, we've seen, you know, from those early days where there were, I really don't want to know what the real number was, but 10 or 12 fishing guides around to 100.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Or, you know, I don't know how many really are that busy, but there are tons of fishing guides around here now. And everybody seems to be busy.
That's right. Yeah, no problem finding clients. That's cool. So, and that's because you're in an area you've got lots of water. Is that what it, I mean, you've got lots of mountains, white water. What is the thing about Tennessee? And I know you're kind of on the east side. But when you look around all these states that are around you, you know, North Carolina, Virginia, Kentucky, what do you think makes Tennessee stick out from the others?
A couple things. I think the Tennessee wildlife actually does a good job managing their fisheries. I bet lots of states couldn't say that, or folks wouldn't say that about other states, but Tennessee wildlife does a great job. And then we've got tailwater. So we've got, you know, rivers that got dammed, and therefore we've got some colder water. That's not typical in the Southeast, which then, you know, allows you to have different kind of fish than you might normally have. And then release schedules that more or less work for us. So these two really great fisheries popped up, and there are certainly more, but that's my home water is South Holston River and Watauga River.
That's right. And those are the two rivers. And so between the South Holston, we've talked about that before. We've had at least a couple of episodes talking about the South Holston. And what is the Watauga? How is that different?
It looks really different. Definitely a different natured kind of river in terms of the geography and topography. The South Holston's a bigger river, a little bit flatter, not as much gradient, and kind of big wide open spaces. It almost feels like you're out west. And the Watauga, you feel like you're on a southern river with big trees all around and some open land, but it's a little bit of a tighter river. And then they fish really differently. They're two different complete fisheries and 20 minutes apart.
Oh, and 20 minutes, yeah. And what's the closest town? Where do you live, or what is the town out there?
So I live in Watauga, which is a crossroads. Johnson City, Tennessee, it would be the closest big town to here, which is 15 minutes away. And the Tri-Cities are the, you know, sort of the three, Kingsport, Bristol, and Johnson City. And then, you know, we're 3 hours from Charlotte and some other big municipalities.
Gotcha, yeah. So you're kind of in the, yeah, you're east Tennessee and up in the north, kind of northeast corner, nearer to Kentucky than any other state, kind of. Or I guess Virginia's right there, too.
Well, Virginia's right here, and then, yeah, I can be in North Carolina in 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah, in North Carolina. Yeah, so you're right there, exactly. Cool. And we're going to be heading to Virginia in the summer, well, probably the spring, kind of into the Shenandoah area. Now, is that a talk about, I'm not sure if you know, the Shenandoah is, how far is that from you? Is that similar to some of the mountains around in Tennessee?
It is similar. And I don't know all of that country and really, honestly, don't know much about most of it. But I did just go up to a fantastic place above Roanoke, an area called Eagle Rock, Virginia, on the James River. Completely enamored with it. It's just beautiful and wide open and not so many fishing guides and a lot of water. You'll enjoy that trip.
Yeah. 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 I mean, we're going out with the Mossy Creek guys. And so it's pretty exciting for that one. But yeah, so you got the Watauga, and how do you spell the Watauga?
Watauga. Took me a couple of years to figure that one out.
Yeah, that one's not easy. That sounds like it must be kind of a Native American, sounds like, word, Watauga?
Yeah, I believe it is a Cherokee word.
Cherokee, yeah, exactly. Cool. Right on. Well, I want to talk, we're going to get into fishing for sure here. I want to talk about, you know, how somebody could fish, but I want to also talk about Blue Ridge. Maybe we could start there really quick, because you have this boat company, which your boat looks like, it's hard to describe. When you first see it, I almost want to call it, I almost thought like, wow, that's like the Tesla of boats almost, you know, it looks very unique. But talk about that. How did this boat company come to be, and why? Just talk about the boat a little bit.
Well, I'll take that description for sure, the Tesla boats. And it does have a different look. So it's really a skiff platform, and we just added some bow and some gunnel height on the front end to keep those anglers dry and be able to go through more whitewater. So in 2015, I think I had an opportunity to row a Boulder Boat Works boat for about half the summer. A client owned it. And was completely inspired by it. I have a whitewater kayaking background, so the notion of plastic hitting rocks as opposed to fiberglass just made a whole bunch of sense to me. The curse of my adult life is I usually think I can build something better or that I can build something myself. So that's how the path got started. I wanted to build a boat, and I wanted a skiff. I'd had plenty of dories and sort of more traditional dory-type drift boats. But the skiffs were hot at the time, and not just coming on, but certainly becoming more popular around here. And so that's what it was. I wanted to build a plastic skiff.
Yeah. And did you have experience building boats in the past, or how? I mean, because it seems like there's lots of wood boat kits out there. You know, people I think can do that, but it seems like building what you build is a little more unique.
Yes. No, I didn't have any experience. I built a sailboat 30 years ago with a college friend. Which had no relationship to this. I do build stuff. I've built houses, and I built our lodge, and I like to build stuff. But I did tell somebody in the middle of the process, this 16-foot boat was the hardest thing I've ever built. You know, there are very few right angles on it. Everything is compound angles. And so designing it and actually constructing the first one was a real task.
Right. So again, you know, it sounds like you're a builder and you've got, you know, that skill. But again, coming back to the boats, I mean, what really got you fired up to be like, I am, instead of just buying a Boulder boat, like building this boat and now having a business around it? I mean, that you took it to the next step.
I think the main thing was that I wanted that skiff and I wanted that plastic. I wanted that you know, it is a high density polyethylene. I wanted that durability. And, you know, there weren't a whole bunch of fiberglass drift boats in my neighborhood for a long time. I mean, I don't know what, 2006 or seven, you started seeing them, and just a few of them. But, you know, we've got a lot of rocks here and we don't always have enough water. And I think we've all kind of decided that hard boats are the way to go. And so we tear them up as a result. So I really wanted that skiff design. And I had also been in enough boats throughout my career to, I think most guys are this way. I want this, or I don't want this. I wish this were designed this way. And so that's what we set out to do, is design a guide boat that was almost indestructible.
Hmm. And so it's made out of a similar material as the boulder boat's the one that's plastic. Is that true?
Yeah, correct. Correct. That's Andy Toohey's creation from a long time ago, and he pioneered it in the drift boat world for sure. And yeah, it's stuff called VHMW. It's a very high molecular weight polyethylene.
Polyethylene. So that's what your boat is, the same material?
Yeah, same material.
And I know we've probably talked about this, I think we have in the past, but building the boat, describe that a little bit. Like, how do you build a MW boat? You know, how it comes together, because it's all smooth. It looks like it's just one, like you poured it literally out of a, you know, a form, right? But how'd you do it?
Yeah, it's a pretty cool process. And we figured it out along the way, and thankfully somebody had pioneered it. It's unlike lots of things, like fixing your vacuum cleaner. You can't go on YouTube and find a bunch of videos on how to do it. So we definitely were scratching our heads for a year. So imagine building that shaped boat out of plywood. So you cut parts and pieces that fit together, and then we use an extrusion welder. You're welding with the exact same material that you're putting together.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And so that welding rod feeds into the back of the gun and extrudes. It's a very expensive Swiss-made glorified hot glue gun.
Sure. My kids would love it. This is awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And we didn't know how to do that at all, but we figured it out.
Yeah, that's it. So basically, it's this plastic. You're kind of doing the same thing, bring it together, and you're welding it, kind of like you might do probably an aluminum boat, I'm guessing, a similar deal.
Yeah, very much so. That's right, the same thing as an aluminum boat, just a different welding process. And I'm not an aluminum welder, and I'm sure that has its difficulties, but this one is a tough piece. And so initially we brought every boat in the world in our shop and pulled it up on the table and had lots of conversations about designs and what we did like and what we didn't like, and tried to figure out what structurally worked and what didn't work. And we sort of built one out of thin plywood at first, just to have something to look at. And or come up with templates. And then we started cutting plastic up. The material is kind of difficult to get. Takes a while to get it. So we got some plastic. We started cutting shapes out and started welding them together. We do it a little bit differently now. We now have done the CAD work for the boat and designed every part and piece on a computer. So now it all gets cut on a CNC machine, which allows us to build them faster and with much more precision.
Gotcha. Nice. And remind us again on that area from where you are in the eastern part of the U.S. How many, are there other boat companies? I know there's at least one or two out there. Are there any in your area?
The only one in our area is really a different kind of craft, but it's High Country Boats. And those guys are friends of ours. We've guided with them and around them for a whole bunch of years. Matt and Les's shop is 6 minutes from my house, or 6 minutes from my shop. So he builds this beautiful, well-thought-out, very expensive piece of art that's highly functional. I shouldn't call it. It's a functional piece of art.
Yeah. Is there more of a, like, the traditional drift boat style with the pointy bow?
You know, he's got a little, it's a little bit of a hybrid, and I would say ours is too. He's definitely got some skiff characteristics, but he does have a pointed bow and has a little bit more of a look of a dory, but I think it operates and rides high like a skiff.
Like a skiff, yeah. And what is the advantage? Like, when I look at your skiff, you know, it's got high sides like some of the drift boats we might see out here. It looks a lot like those boats, but it's got the skiff front. So what's the advantage of the skiff? Is that just a fishing advantage, or why is that better than just having the pointed bow?
Well, honestly, I've rode more dories in my life than I have skiffs, but here's what I think about them. They typically have a wider platform, or our boat does for sure, but they typically have a wider platform, so you've got a little more room in the boat. It offers a whole bunch of stability side to side that you don't have in a dory, in a traditional dory.
Oh, right. And the stability comes from being wider.
Yeah, it has that. You got that width. So you got more surface area and therefore more displacement, and therefore your boat rides higher. And so you get that stability. So, and all skiffs are not stable, and they might be wide, but then they get narrow in the front and back. And our boat's got a fairly wide platform from front to back.
Yes. For how many inches is it? Like the width, like how you make, usually boats are measured like 16 by 54. What is your boat?
It's 15-10 overall. There's like 14-6 at waterline. The whole piece on the bottom is 58 inches, and then it's about 70 inches at the gunwale height.
Yeah, so 58. So it's 4 inches. Like I've got a 17 by 54 Koffler boat, and so yours is 4 inches wider at the. That's where it's measured, right? When you hear that number,
yeah.
It's measured down at the bottom of the boat, the width.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So yours is 4 inches. Yeah.
A little bit wider, and then it kind of stays wide front and back in comparison to other kinds of boats.
Oh, that's where the stability comes in. So like my boat or a lot of these traditional dory boats are probably narrower. They're pointed, so you don't get it. You lose the stability. That's where it comes from.
Yeah, that's right. And then the other piece about skiffs is that often you've got some kind of flat space from front to back. So that gives you some stability front to back, but often doesn't let you run as big a whitewater as a traditional.
Squalla Fly Fishing, combining advanced materials with fishing-focused, purpose-built design. Squalla waders, jackets, shirts, pants, and insulation are made for us. To help Wet Fly Swing listeners right now, Squalla is offering a 10% discount on your next order. Just visit squallafishing.com and use the coupon code WETFLYSWING10 at checkout. That's Squalla, S-K-W-A-L-A, gear for us, the serious angler. Now, going back to the history, because we had a few episodes on this with one of the guys that wrote the book on boat building. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. But he described the history. You know, his book really did the history of drift boats. And he talked about how, you know, there's two types. There's like the Mackenzie style and there's the Rogue style. You know, and it depends on how the boat is, like you're talking about. If there's a flat area in the middle, then that's more of the Rogue style, I believe. And then the Mackenzie style is just has a constant bend in the entire boat. You kind of know, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I've read that book at some point, probably a long time ago.
Yeah.
It does make sense. And then I think two things happen there. I think you have the ability or lack thereof to row bigger whitewater. And then the other is the way that the boat feels in your hands. And, you know, the person that's rowing the boat, the nimbleness or lack thereof.
Yeah. So you're saying your boat has a flat section on it.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah. And that gives it more stability. And I think, you know, when I look back to that podcast we have, the boats they made for the Grand Canyon, which is, I had this period of time where I just couldn't stop watching those videos of those boats flipping over and flipping back. But they made those specifically, Martin Linton and that crew, or I guess the people that designed them, they made them with that flat section so they could go through the giant whitewater. Right. There was something in it where because of that little flat section, it did a better job. Maybe it didn't stick in the whitewater, but I guess there's something where if the flat does help for the really big stuff, but what you're saying is the flat doesn't always help for whitewater versus say a Mackenzie, you know what I mean? Like my boat's a Mackenzie, which is, it has a curve. The whole bottom of the boat has a slight curve.
I think that those, the Grand Canyon is a different animal. That's a big piece of whitewater that none of us are ever trying to fish down. But
now, are you trying to, is the Grand Canyon on your list? Is that something you would love to take your boat down the Grand Canyon and try it out?
You know, I don't know about that. I'd love to build a Grand Canyon dory for sure. I'd love to build a plastic one. And I think that's how Andy got his, that was Andy's original inspiration was, I want to build a Grand Canyon boat.
Oh, wow.
For Boulder. Yeah. Way back in the day. No, I've been down the Grand Canyon and it's one of the best things you could ever do, but I'm sure the next time I go down, I'll go in a kayak and not in a rowboat.
What did you go down in?
I actually did it with a group and we were all in rafts, but I think that part of what gets you up and over waves is that rocker, that continuous bend from front to back. And then bow height, gunwale height, the combination of the two. I think that's what, and keeping people dry. And that's what we, our boat looks a little different because we wanted the skiff platform. We wanted the low gunwales to stay out of the wind and allow you to be able to not get pushed around too much. But we also wanted to be able to keep your front angler dry. From a guide's perspective, if I don't have to put clients and waders in the spring, I won't. They're much more comfortable in their other clothing and not have to wader them up because we're going to keep them dry on the boat, generally speaking.
Gotcha. So your boat, and as you look at it again, it's big, right? High side. So could you take this down any, could you take this through class 4 rapid, you know, like stuff on the, not the Grand Canyon, but just I'm thinking stuff like, you know, we have the Deschutes, some rivers where there's actually decent size waves.
Yes, I think you can. And I don't have a ton of, I mean, I've got a ton of guiding days in our boat, but I don't have a ton of recreational sort of whitewater days. But we do have a significant class 3 rapid on the upper Watauga, and I can run the meat of that anytime and keep people dry.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, and again, boats are, you know, no matter what boat you have, there's still a person that's running the boat, that's rowing it. And I've been in boats that I filled the boat up with water before. You know, I had one section where I almost swamped a drift boat. And so part of it is, right, you still got to run the boat, keep it straight, don't take stuff over the side. But even yours looks like you have even the higher side, the front even has, typically it's higher versus the back, right? It looks like you really optimized this for dryness.
Yeah. So I think a couple things, and the back half of our boat is not any higher than lots of the other skiffs out there. It might look that way in the picture. I think that gunwale height is, I don't know what it is, 20 inches, something like that. And then, but where most people hump up for the oarlocks, where that gunwale line rises for the oarlocks, and that's really done for the rower to have the correct ratio of oars not hitting their knees. Most people on skiffs will take that gunwale line back down, that whatever that 3 inches is, and then that's your sort of gunwale height all the way to the front of the boat. We kept that gunwale rail up and then gave it a little more rocker, so we've got an additional 6 inches, essentially, of gunwale height up front. I've been in a couple of skiffs that were super low profile, you know, I'm sure stay well out of the wind most of the time, but there's also this sense of, like, I might fall out of this thing.
Right. Well, how is that with your boat? I mean, because I actually rode a hide this in Idaho for the first time, a really low. It was the first time rowing one of those, you know, what we're talking about here. I guess it's a pram or I guess river skiff, whatever, but
yeah,
super low sides. And one of the nice things I did find about it is that, man, was it easy to step out of the boat? I mean, from any section, you literally just hopped out. That was probably maybe the biggest, well, and it was really easy to row. So that was cool because my boat is high side. And I think your boat actually maybe isn't as high as the boat I have, but it's, I usually just hop out of it, right? I mean, it's not easy to get in and out of the boat. But some boats you see, what is it? Is it Pavardi? I'm not sure if I say that right, Pavardi or whatever, but they have this door. Have you seen that boat?
I've seen that. Super cool. Yeah.
Yeah, with the door. So
yeah,
features like that, have you thought about adding some of those types of features? Like, I don't know, you know, that makes it a little bit easier to getting in and out of your boat? Or do you feel like your boat's pretty dialed as it is?
I think it's pretty dialed. I mean, I think, you know, I'm showing it to as many folks out there as I can these days, especially guides, and everybody's got an opinion about what they think. Yeah. And I also came to the table with a sense of, okay, I've been rowing a boat for a living for 25 years. I have a decent sense of what should and should not be in the boat. And from a guide's perspective, so I do think our boat's really easy to get in and out of, especially on the back end of it. And I'm usually backing up to whatever shoreline I'm trying to get to anyway and dropping the anchor because it's the best way out of the boat. And this plastic's so slick, you can't pull your boat up on shore and let people out and not drop the anchor because it'll just slide right back in the water.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's crazy cool.
So it slides over rocks and boulders. Yes. Really nicely.
Amazingly, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, and it's durable. So I guess those are some of the features with the plastic boat. Is it more durable than a fiberglass boat?
Substantially.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
So that's one of the big things. Is it heavier or lighter than a fiberglass comparable size?
It's probably right in there. You know, I think, first of all, there's not a whole lot of truth telling in the weight world on drift boats.
Oh, really?
But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, nobody yeah. wants some crazy high number. But so our boat without oars in it weighs 460 pounds. And that's kind of right in there with everybody else. I mean, it's ready to fish. So you'll hear some under 200 pound numbers from people, but that is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's a hull with nothing in it. You'll see that listed like a hull weight, and that's not an accurate number.
Sure. That's without all the, I mean, add in, like I see you got a couple of coolers, right? You add in a Yeti cooler too. You're adding, those things aren't light, right? You got that stuff and then everything else.
Yeah. That's super heavy. And you know, it's pretty common to have a 98 pound person one day on your boat and a 300 pound person the next day on your boat. The range varies. So we all, I think as guides, we get stuck, our boat lovers and boat owners, we get stuck on some number that may or may not have that big of a difference.
That's cool.
Yeah. So this material is not any lighter than the rest of it. It's just incredibly durable.
Yeah. Just durable. And you have the handles right at the front and back. Is that just for, it's so slick you got to hang on to, or what is that? Because that looks kind of cool too. Like being able to, or can you pick up the boat, literally pick the boat up?
Well, a couple of people could pick the boat up for sure. But I think, you know, sometimes in the guide world, you'll have a riffle that you don't want to necessarily drop anchor in, or you can't drop anchor in, but you can step out real quick and just grab the back of the boat and let the boat hang and let your anglers fish or run real quick. And or, you know, some of these bony low water rivers that we have around here. And certainly this year we've had a low water year. You know, it's common to get out and push your boat around a little bit and get it over some rock obstacle and keep your clients in the boat. And so we just kind of felt like it was an easy thing to do and make it a little more user-friendly.
Gotcha. And one more question. I'm just looking at this. So, you know, the gunwales, right? I just think, again, like maybe traditional boat, you have a gunwale. What is the reason to go away from the gunwale? Because there are some advantages. I can think of one being that you just have more tie-down points, you know, on the boat. That's one thing I use it for. But why not have the gunwales? Or what are even the gunwales used for?
Okay, so like a proper gunwale rail is what you're talking about.
Yeah, the rail that goes like right along where the oar lock is around the whole up top of the boat. I don't know what you call that top of the drift boat around the sides is.
The gunwale is the top of the drift boat, or in the top of any boat for that matter. And then what you see in most drift boats is some kind of rail there. And that's always done for structure. And aesthetically it's nice as well, but it's done for structure.
Yeah, right. Because wooden boats, it all started with wooden boats and they needed the structure, right? It was a piece of plywood.
They needed the structure. You need something up there to hold that side piece all in one place. You see it on the aluminum boats. You see it on the glass boats. The glass boats, they've rolled it or curved it oftentimes.
Yeah, they curved it.
Yeah.
Right.
So our first couple of boats had gunwale rails on them, and they were made out of plastic. You know, we wanted this thing to be maintenance-free. So they were made out of plastic. They were actually, initially, they were difficult to build and make look right. And then we realized pretty quickly they were heavy. They added a bunch more weight to it. And then at some point, we just pulled them off of the first boat we built and realized we didn't need them. So we didn't need them. The rod trays that are just below gunwale line offer all the structure we needed. So we just pulled them off.
Yeah, you got the rod trays and storage on the sides. And then you did go with a little bit of a nice, the wood touch, right? You added that. Why add the wood touch? Because that's going to be some maintenance long-term, right? Why not just have that plastic as well?
Well, to be completely honest, those wood thigh braces that you see on some of the boats out there, that's really a function of us not having an inch and a half thick sheet of plastic, which was very expensive.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yep. So that piece of plastic's expensive. And initially we didn't have the money or didn't have the money to buy it. So we started making them out of wood, and that's pretty familiar with us. Now I have that sheet of plastic, so I make those out of plastic as well.
Oh, you do. So now it is plastic and not wood.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, that can be an option for somebody. I do think it looks good, but it is a maintenance issue. And I won't speak for all guides, but most guides aren't super high on the maintenance part of the world.
No, I'm not either. My boat, I love that I could like literally just, I mean, my boat sits outside in the rain
yeah,
just all the time. And I love it because I don't have to worry about it. It's aluminum. Nothing's ever going to happen to it. Is the plastic same thing? Can you just leave this thing outside all year long?
Yeah, I don't think it's great for except for some of the metals out there, like the aluminum. I don't think the UV is good for any wood, fiberglass, plastic. You're getting plenty of it on the river. You know, one of our early boats that went to a guide around here bragged to me the other day that his boat had never been inside its entire time. It was great. It was all fine structural. In the long run, I think it's best if you can keep it out of the weather all the, you know, not 24/7, really just for UV issues. I mean, this material has a UV inhibitor, but yeah, that was the idea. It's these current boats, there's some stainless steel hardware. There's a few pieces of aluminum, anchor arms and things like that. And then outside of that, it's just maintenance free, all plastic.
And the trailer, that's always another thing. Is that something you guys had made for the boats, or is that something you guys also make?
It is. Trailers are tough here in the east, on the East Coast. Most of them are made out west. It's a low demand but very specific trailer, and we actually have a great bunch of folks in South Carolina that have been building trailers since the 40s that we sent our specs to them. They built a prototype, and now they've built us a couple of really nice all galvanized trailers.
Yeah, looks great. Okay, perfect. Well, anything else on the boats? I want to jump into the fishing a little bit, and we can save some of this till the end, but did we kind of describe it? You know, anything else you want to tell somebody if they're thinking about checking this out?
I would just say, please check us out. We have we've done everything we know how to do to make it real high quality. It's all made in the U.S. Everything on the boat's made in the U.S. I definitely am targeting a bunch of guides that are still fishing out of rafts because they're fishing rivers where they just hit too many rocks, and they're very uncomfortable with the idea of destroying their fiberglass boat. And this is a boat that I think you can get around that.
You can. So this is a boat where if you got a lot of rocks, and typically people are thinking, you know, I'm not going to take a drift boat. I mean, one river I think of that would be great, actually, they do take wood boats, but like the Middle Fork of the Salmon, that might be a little large whitewater, but that is can be a bony river. I'd imagine your boat might be a really sweet boat for that. But is that the kind of the case where if you have a river that's really bony, lots of banging, your boat might be a good fix for that?
Well, we think it's a great option. I think, you know, everybody hits a rock and kind of cringes no matter what your boat is made of, but fiberglass is tough. I mean, it tears it up. And these boats, I don't want to say indestructible, but they're pretty close. We've had guides for the last 4 years beating them to death, which is cool.
Yeah, cool. And one other thing, I was just looking at, so at the bow, you know, typically the skiffs, those river skiffs, or what's the typical name of what you call like that hide, the boat that you see in Montana, Idaho, in the West? What are those called?
Are you talking about skiffs or dories?
Yeah, just skiff. I guess that's just a skiff, right?
Yeah.
Just a skiff. So what, drift boat skiff? So those are flat. Most of them I've seen complete. Yours is flat, but it's got a little point. Is that, what's the reason there? Why not have that completely flat? And does it have a little point, almost like a little pointy bow?
It does, and I think it's a function of a couple of things. One is, I think, aesthetics. I think it looks good. It definitely will part the water there, whatever you're kind of going through. Anything that you're not getting up and over, that bow will split that water. And then it gives you a little bit more cockpit room because you're just pushing the front of that boat out there a little bit.
Gotcha. This is cool. Awesome. Well, I think I want to check a little on, you know, the fishing and maybe talk about that. I mean, those will probably, you know, lie right in with the drift boat. But talk about that. You mentioned the Watuga River. Is that a river where you need a boat to fish? Describe how you're catching fish there, what that looks like.
Yes, it's the Watuga River, and it is highly used by drift boats and quite an active guide service going on. But we usually get good flows. So it's a little bit different between the South Holston and the Watauga. South Holston is 20 minutes from here. At optimal flows on the Watauga, you can wade fish and float the river. So it's this nice medium level that allows anglers to safely get out there and on foot. But there are a bunch of fishing guides here, all in drift boats. And the South Holston's a little bit different than that. Usually at optimal floating water levels, it's not safe wading.
Not safe. Okay. So on the Watauga, what is the, you know, what are you guys doing there? Is this a kind of nymphing, dry flies, string, like everything, or how are you catching fish there?
So we're doing everything. There's 20 miles of river between the Wilbur Dam, which is what our water comes out of, and Boone Lake. So there's quite a few sections, quite a few access points, and quite a few guides, and everybody kind of has their spot. But yeah, so it's a dry and dropper, great dry flies. We're known for a caddis hatch that we have here, good terrestrial fishing. It's spawning time of year right now, so there's blue wings coming off, and hopefully some people are leaving those fish alone a little bit, but there's still plenty of fishing going on.
Oh, there is. Yeah. So can you fish, are people fishing pretty much year round down there?
They are. On the Watauga, there's no closed water. On the South Holston, there are several sections that are closed for spawning. But on the Watauga, the whole river's open.
Oh, the whole river. Okay. And so if somebody was thinking about coming up there, what would be your advice if they're, you know, they're maybe coming through the area? What's a good time to be planning a trip there? How does that? And you have, maybe you could talk, you know, tie this into your lodge because you've got a program there as well.
Yeah, we have a lodge and guide service here, and there are multiple guide services around. So we've got great accommodations right on the river, kind of arguably some of the best fishing on the river is right from our place. And then we have a guide service, and I will not include myself in this, but we've got really great guides that are seasoned, know the river well, and take care of clients in a great way. That's certainly a good way. We've got several fly shops around, and they can outfit anyone, and certainly the wade anglers tend to probably need those services as well. So there's good fishing here, and everybody's pretty friendly and respectful of each other, you know, two different kinds of traffic.
Get ready to explore the wild with Northern Rockies Adventures. Imagine yourself surrounded by pristine waters, towering mountains, and the thrill of landing a trophy fish like the majestic Arctic grayling or the elusive bull trout. With over 40 years experience guiding anglers through these breathtaking landscapes, Daniel's family-operated trips promise not just a fishing journey, but an adventure of a lifetime. From the convenience of Vancouver, BC, dive into an all-inclusive experience that caters to every detail of your trip so you can focus on the thrill of each hookup. Take a look for yourself at nradventures.com/wetflyswing and discover the Northern Rockies like never before. That's N as in Northern, R as in Rockies, adventures.com. You support this podcast by checking in at nradventures.com. So is the lodge, is this like an all-inclusive? People are staying there for like a day, week? How's that look?
Well, it's not all-inclusive. So none of us wanted to be or knew how to be in the food business. So we have really great cabins on the river, very well appointed, very comfortable. And then we've got this really fun outdoor living space right by the water. And there's a full kitchen there. So everything you would need to prepare and serve a meal for your group is right there. There's a big fire pit. Really fun place to be. We're also close. We're 5 minutes from Elizabethton, Tennessee, and 12 minutes from downtown Johnson City. So we've got a bunch of a variety of great local restaurants. And then, of course, we'll feed you on the river when you're floating with us. So that's kind of how that works.
Gotcha. So it's pretty much, accommodations and bring your own food sort of thing for dinner, that sort of thing. But I can see it now. You're on the river. And are you pretty much fishing? You said 20 miles. Is it kind of in the middle? Or are you putting in like at the lodge floating down? Or how does that look?
Yeah, we're right in the middle. I think we're at mile 12. So, yeah, and that's morphed over the years. So traditionally, we used to be right in the middle of the main run, the run that was used most frequently. And that's changed a little bit. It seems like folks have migrated upstream. So often our place is a takeout for our crew. Sometimes it's a launch. And then there are multiple access points, you know, from the top to the bottom.
Top to the bottom. Okay. And if I was talking here thinking, okay, we're setting up a trip for 2024 or 2025, what would you be telling me as far as the best time to come and put together a great trip there?
So most of the guides around here love late March. The fish are dumb and hungry. And assuming we don't have some kind of crazy water year, you've got real great water levels on the high side of things, but great water levels. Spring is super busy around here. It's real fishy. Lots of bug activity, lots of good fishing, also lots of traffic. And then our fishery stays really productive all the way through July. With terrestrials and all kinds of, you know, some kind of midge hatching every day. And if we have a slow time of the year, it's often August because it's hot, low, dry, and the fish are educated. A rainy summer will dispel all of that. We've had a couple of rainy Augusts in the last few years that just like, wow, the fishing's fantastic, and it shouldn't be, but it is. And then, of course, fall. Everybody loves the fall.
The fall's good. So when does the fall start getting good, and when does it slow down?
So second half of September, depends on what the weather's doing, but it'll start cooling off. The weather feels different, looks different. The light, the sunlight hits the water differently. And I think the fish, you know, they start eating much better after coming through a warm summer. They'll start to feed for sure.
Oh, right. Okay. So, and then like you said, now it's, you know, coming up on Christmas here. So it's still fishing like right now, still great.
It is. I think most of the guides, and typically it's mid-March all the way to Thanksgiving is what everybody would consider our real season. But we certainly get pretty temperate weather around here. And depending on the weather, we might stay real busy in December. But then lots of folks are switching gears and holidays and shooting sports and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. And well, let's just say if we were coming there in March, and are there hatches that, is that what's going on? You mentioned the caddis hatch. When does that one kick off?
So people really talk about that being the first or second week in April, sort of prime time. But that'll start earlier than that. Again, it really kind of depends on how much winter lingers around here. It is the South, so you can have a 30 degrees one day and 58 the next. It changes pretty radically. Yeah, so early March, you won't have a lot of hatch activity, but you'll have great nymphing. It starts getting a little bit better. April, you start getting caddis hatches. And then we'll have crane fly hatches, sulfur hatches, midges all the time. And then all summer, we'll have pretty good terrestrial fishing as well. And then right now, a bluebird day can be tough. A cloudy day will just, the blue-winged olives will pour off.
Oh, right. So, yeah, you're still getting that. And on, you know, back to that early April, so with the caddis, what does that hatch look like? Is this, talk about how you're fishing. Is this something where you're fishing elk hair caddis, or what does that, you know, look like?
Well, I think you're doing it all. I think that's a frustrating hatch. I think that, you know, like lots of hatches, you're trying to throw an imitation in the midst of 10,000 real bugs. And that can always be tough. And I think these fish get smart pretty quick as well. But yeah, so swinging flies is always great. Proper dry fly casting and proper topwater eats happen a bunch. But they'll get picky. And I think they get picky because it'll get busy here.
Yeah. And are you fishing? So like you talked swinging flies, is this mostly out of the boat on that river? Like everything you're doing? Or are you stopping at all and getting out?
Yeah, I mean, we might on occasion, but we tend not to. I think at least around here, I don't have experience around the world, but at least around here, the float guides, they want to float. They want to be in their boat. They want their office right there. They want everything at their fingertips, and they love fishing out of the boat. And you see younger guys that tend to be more of the wade guides around here, but as soon as they get middle age and they've started floating a bunch, they don't tend to do both.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, what would be your, you know, again, just I'm always trying to get a few tips thinking about the fishing you guided for, sounds like 25 years. I mean, what were your, if somebody's there on the Watauga, they're fishing, say they got their own drift boat, they're doing this thing, what would be a few tips, your biggest tips, guide tips you would give that person to maybe have a good day on that river?
I'd say go back to the basics. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, I'm older, so, you know, fishing stuff that worked 20 years ago actually still works and might work better today than some of the new things. I think sometimes people coming here with their own boat can be intimidated because there's so much guide traffic. And I think generally speaking, it's a great bunch of guides around here. Everybody's pretty friendly. Nobody's trying to be in a war, and nobody's extremely territorial. So I think that's a pretty easy part. And then reach out to somebody that's local and they'll give you tips about where to go, where to float. And there are other, you know, guide services around here as well. We've got 3 shuttle drivers around here that can move your car. So that's pretty cool and easy. And then I love to dry and dropper fish.
Yeah. The dry dropper, that's the easiest, the best method maybe?
I think it is. And I think, you know, outside of some high water scenarios, I think that's what most people are fishing here most of the time.
It's the dry dropper, which is, you could have a, what would be a typical dry dropper setup you'd use on that river, say in the spring?
Some kind of bushy caddis fly that they would eat and that you can also see. And, you know, some 6X and some kind of nymph. I love soft tackles. There's a lot of good nymphs out there, but some kind of nymph that gets you down there. And I'll tend to fish a little bit deeper than some. I'll drop it 3 feet down for sure.
Right. And this is just where you tie on the big bushy. I'm trying to think of what would be the big bushy fly. I mean, there's all sorts of.
Well, a big caddis, you know, but what everybody does is a chubby.
Yeah, chubby, right. Yeah. Just throw a chubby on. Yeah. So it floats high and it's foamy and all that stuff. And then off the bend of the hook, you just tie a 6X tippet with a fly down there, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's it. It's that easy.
Yeah.
Then you kind of get the best of both worlds, right?
Yeah. There's one, and we were talking about the Henry, or I guess the South Fork, the snake, and somebody was mentioning that, sometimes it's better just to go with the big fly because it's easier to get it right against the bank. You know, like you got to literally, if you almost hit that bank, that's where the fish are. Like, is that the case on this river? How do you find fish on the Watuga? Are they everywhere? Or are they against the bank? You know, how's that looking for you guys?
Well, they are everywhere. We've got a bunch of great riffly kind of runs, and they're kind of spread out throughout. And then we've got other sort of more pool drop runs where there'll be a specific run in it. So I love to fish those edges. I love to fish right down the middle of it as well. I think that's the other thing, is that I've found that if you will fish slightly differently than that boat in front of you, you'll do better. Or slightly different than the three boats you just saw go through that run. If you're new to the area, you'll probably do better. There's probably just as many fish, and they just didn't get floated over.
Yeah. Just looking at your website now, I guess this is WatugaRiverLodge.com, right? That's your website?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. You have a couple of little things here at the top, the Watuga River fly fishing. You say the Watuga River, located in eastern Tennessee, is regarded as one of the best trout fishing destinations in the South, supporting over 2,000 fish per mile. Seems befitting that the Cherokee translation for Watuga is River of Plenty. That's a nice that's a nice first little paragraph to have at the top. Is that so in the South, and I mean, you guys are all in the South, this is one of those rivers. This is one of the ones you kind of have to fish, a major river.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think people from elsewhere might have heard of the South Holston a little bit more. Maybe it's got a little more press coverage, and it's great. It's a fantastic fishery. It's also tough and finicky. I've had the best days of my life on that river and the worst as a guide. And there's almost two different guide sets around here. There are guides that really consider the South Holston their home water, and then there are guides that really consider the Watuga their home water. So, but full of fish. And I think the Watuga is a little more user-friendly day in and day out for your clients.
Yeah, yeah. This is awesome. No, I see it. And it's definitely the river. Yeah, it's made like a drift boat. I mean, you probably see rafts on it too, but it's definitely fishing out of the boat with dry dropper. You can do that all day long and catch tons of fish on the Watuga. Yeah.
I think the guides love the ability to either control and or help that client get that drift. And that's much harder to do on foot.
Yeah. Well, let's, I want to take it out here with our little listener shout out segment here. And this one is to Brent Moore, who I'm going to read something. He sent an email in. And for folks out there listening, they can do the same thing. Send an email if they want to get a shout out here. But Brent said, I've been listening to the podcast since the Trey Cones episode in 6 years ago. So Brent's been listening since the start. He said, I really appreciate the entertainment education that you've given to thousands on this. And he talked a little about just he wanted to hear some of the courses we have going. We just got done with this trip with Jeff Liskay, and he mentioned he wanted to know where those courses are at. So we're doing some of that stuff, but I want to give a shout out to drifthook.com. They actually had a piece. I searched it on their site. It's like the 21 places to fish in Tennessee, I think is what it was. But if you had to think about that, and I know you don't know Tennessee as much, as maybe East Tennessee, but are there's some other famous waters around Tennessee? What would be another one that you would think of in Tennessee that somebody might want to fish?
Well, the Caney Fork, especially if you're going to Nashville, the Caney Fork is a fishery that is certainly known around here. The Nolichucky, I love the Nolichucky for smallmouth bass fishing.
Oh, small, right. And we haven't even talked about that. So today we really haven't been talking about smallmouth, which you've done a lot of too.
Yeah. I mean, it's still kind of the fit. If I'm going fishing personally, it's the fish I go for. I don't often trout fish for personal pleasure, but I love the smallmouth fish. So you've got the main Holston or Holston proper and the Nolichucky, and both great smallmouth fisheries. And then the Caney Fork's the other one that if you're close to Nashville, that's a good fishery. People are definitely catching fish there. And outside of that, I don't know. I've been, I haven't fished much west of here.
Oh, west, yeah. And I'm just thinking, so South Holston, and then another one that we've talked about here was the Hiawassee?
Right.
Yeah, so that's another one. But So I am looking at this drifthook.com 21 places to go, and it's pretty cool because he talked about, you know, he's got the South Holston in here. And really, you know, a bunch of these, I'll just name a few: Abrams Creek, Cane Creek, Caney Fork River, Chickamauga Reservoir, Clinch River. I mean, there's a bunch on here. So it sounds like, again, you know, Tennessee has a lot of water. I mean, I guess that's at the end of the day, there's tons of fishing opportunities in Tennessee, it sounds like.
Tons of fishing opportunities. And you're, you know, from our little part of the world here, you're super close to Southwest Virginia, Western North Carolina, even North Georgia.
Yeah, North Georgia, exactly. No, it's tons. The more of these episodes I do in your neck of the woods, the more you realize, yeah, I mean, there's just tons of opportunities and great fishing. And like you said, 2,000 fish per mile, that's a pretty solid number of fish to have in the river, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Nice. Okay. Well, I guess, you know, just thinking back, you know, again, on where we're at. So if we're fishing this river, what would be your recommendation? You know, again, if you don't have a drift boat, maybe call your guys. You've got some guides there. Book a place. If somebody wanted to book a spot for a night there, how would they do that?
Super easy. You can send me an email at watagariverlodge.com. You can call the number that's on the website, and that's my number. You can shoot me a text. Easy to look at available dates for accommodations and guides as well. And then if you are just coming to the area and need some info, give me a shout. I'll be glad to send you in the right direction.
Okay, good. And I'm just, again, I'm looking more at this. I'm going to call out Matt at Drift Hook. I'm going to see if he's got the Watugon here. He's got his little summary. He talks a little about the history. It drains into the Gulf of Mexico, right? Which is interesting. That's another thing you don't think as much about. But recommended fly patterns, zebra midge, Adams and flashback pheasant tail beadhead. Are those patterns that you would use there?
Yeah, and those are, I wouldn't call them old school, but they've been used around here for a long time and they definitely still work.
Yeah, they still work. Yeah, so that would be one, like you said, with the dry dropper, you could put a big puffy Chernobyl on and then on the end have a zebra midge or a flashback pheasant tail. That would be a good combo.
Yeah, you'd be safe. And I think, I mean, you might be safe to do that anywhere in the world, but you'd be safe to do that here and catch fish for sure.
Okay, perfect. So good. So we got Matt's covered. Drifthook.com, actually, they sell flies. So if you want a box, I'm sure they could have you covered there. But yeah, anything else we want to cover here about your area? I mean, you've got a lot going. It seems like you got this drift boat company. You've got a lodge. You were a guide for 25 years. I mean, what's your focus as you think now looking ahead? Is it all boats, all lodge? How do you stay focused?
Well, the lodge business is something I know and love and have been doing for a long time. And I'll continue to do. The boat business is relatively new. I'm doing it with my son, which I love, and I'm super excited about that. I feel like we've got a product that will be useful for a bunch of people in a bunch of places. I feel like it was designed specifically for guides, but I think most clients end up wanting that kind of setup. So I am extremely excited about that portion of my work life.
Yeah. And do you guys spend, I mean, how many, you know, boat-wise are you thinking, you know, I mean, eventually if you could make that like your full thing, would that be is that what you're looking for? You know, getting to a point where the boat business is basically the full deal?
I feel like I've been multitasking my whole life and I'll probably continue to do that. So our place on the river is not going anywhere. So we'll continue to do that. And then, yeah, I mean, I'm looking at my son's future and our future, and we love to build stuff together. We our shop is on our property, so we love that part of it. It's at my home, so I'm definitely looking to increase that and crank a bunch of boats out and sell them.
Yeah. How long does it take you to build a boat from start to finish? If you had to just be like, all right, I'm going to build this boat from scratch or start to finish.
We can build one in about 2 weeks now. That was a radically different number in the beginning. And now that we've got the CAD process done and the CNC machine cutting the materials, it's amazing how quickly you can put it together.
Right. And on the lodge, what does that look like being a lodge owner? It sounds like maybe you don't have the food, so there's not that, but what's the daily look like there? What are you doing as a lodge owner?
Well, we keep it looking pretty. I've got another son that helps me. He's helping me this time of year. We keep it looking pretty. It's kind of the your typical sort of maintaining a home kind of thing. And this really, it was just an extension of sort of the guide piece of sort of taking care of people. So I feel like I've been in the hospitality business, either in a boat or at the lodge my whole life. And I like that part. I feel like I've told a bunch of people this, I had a very successful career as a guide, and not necessarily because I was a rock star guide, but I take care of clients. I make friends with my clients, and they want to come back.
And you got out of guiding. What was the, did you feel like you just had the right time, or did you say I was going to put in a certain amount of time, or do you miss the guiding at all?
I don't miss the guiding. I do miss being, being on the river every day. And that was, that was one of the very best parts of it, was pushing offshore and floating down the river every day. I wasn't as good at it as I once was. I am about to be 57. So there's a bunch of guys younger than me that are more obsessed with it than I am. And they're better at it. And so that was part of it for me, was just realizing that, okay, I'm not as good at this as I used to be. Also felt, the older I got, the harder it became to manage being a full-time guide and manage the lodge and have this upstart boat business. So something had to go.
Right. Yeah. You can't, that's the thing. You can't do everything. And yeah, I think the guide that we've talked, obviously, to many guides on here, and I feel like, it's the guide is this amazing hard, it's a hard job, but like when you're made for it, I always go back to Jeff Liskey because he's one of our, we do these steelhead trips in Ohio, and he's just, man, he's got that skill. Like you could just see, like even on this last trip we just did, he did everything, and I watched him guide, and this, he had Ed. So Ed was, this is pretty cool. So Ed was one of our clients on this trip. We did this hosted trip. He built this bamboo spay rod. He was fishing with a silk line, a horsehair leader, traditional line. And so that was his goal. Like he wanted to catch a steelhead on this all traditional, and he wasn't getting it, he was in this spot and we knew the fish were there. I mean, these fish were stacked in here and then Jeff came in and gave him a couple little pointers, whatever it was. And like, he hooked up with the steelhead.
Yeah.
And Jeff was as excited about him. And at the end, it was just, you could just see it. And then finally I left. And then the next day Jeff hung around and gave the guys an extra day for free, essentially.
Super cool.
Wasn't even planned. You know what I mean? So that's the sort of thing, like that is why, like he is just, and he loves it. And I know he works like 24/7 too. So I feel like, and I hear you because I guided too and I sucked at it. I was a terrible guide. You know what I mean? So it's one of those things that, do you feel like that? People, or there's some guides that are just made for guiding. It's like their thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the typical, at least around here. So we've got this Appalachian State University. It's 45 minutes from here. Super outdoorsy town, and has spawned a whole bunch of young fishing guides. And, there's a typical, like, come straight out of college, guide for a couple years, and then go get a real job. And some of them, they're just cut out for it. They're obsessed with it. They want it. They're good at it. And they just keep doing it. And, there are certainly not as many 56-year-old guides out there, but there are a few. I do think that. I think those great guides that you see out there that are 40 or 45 or 50 or whatever, they were so obsessed as youngsters that they just, that's all they wanted to do. And I felt like that myself at some point. I think that to me, what makes a great guide is this ability to read your people, get them to catch fish, and make sure they feel like they're taken care of in the whole process. It's not that hard.
Right. That's perfect. Well, let's take two things, and then we'll two more questions, and then we'll get out of here. One is on resources. So thinking about that area, you said, you got some fly shops. Where do you direct somebody if they want to learn more? Is there a local fly shop, or what's the best? Or just connect with one of the guides there?
So there's a couple spots. There's Mahoney's Outfitters in Johnson City, and they're kind of a full-service outfitter, but they definitely have a fly shop. And then a newer fly shop around here, some great guys that I've recently gotten to know, the Fly Box, which is on the South Holston.
Oh, nice. River.
Yeah, not too far away. They all guide. I get them to help me as often as I can. They're good guides. And then there are multiple guides. I mean, if you Google, fishing South Holston or Watauga, you'll come up with a bunch of guide services as well.
Okay. And so that's kind of where you'll get people that'll come in that'll maybe be just staying at your place, and they're like, hey, who do we go for a guide? And then you can send them out to those people.
Well, we have our own guide service. So, I mean.
Oh, yeah, you have your own.
Yeah, I love for people to come straight to us, and we take care of you in all capacities. But I also have these other guides that will send clients our way as well. So we lodge people without guiding them as well.
Okay. And what about, so food, if somebody was going to be up there, what would be your recommendation? Is there a place, a restaurant you love where they can get a nice dinner after the day on the water?
Yeah, our little downtown in Johnson City has had this really fun revitalization happen in the last 10 years. So we've got a full variety of locally owned restaurants that are actually quite a few of them really close to each other. Label is one of them. Southern Craft is another. We've got fantastic pizza at Main Street Pizza. So there's that. And then, you know, I'm always telling folks, get your groceries at Ingles and come to the lodge and hang out. And you don't have to go anywhere. And
yeah, that's right. Cause they can do it all there. Just get some food at Ingles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ingles. Okay. Yeah. And then cook it up at sounds like you have an outdoor kitchen.
Yeah. There's a full outdoor kitchen. There's a big gas grill and a fire pit. And it's fun to get off the river and have a cocktail and sit by the fire. And it's good.
That sounds perfect. Good. Okay. And one last one. So just on the podcast music, are you more of a music fan or more of a podcast listener if you're on the road heading to a fishing destination?
I am a music person.
Music. Okay. Yeah. So can you leave us with a tune, a band, a genre of music that we could throw in the show notes, or what are you listening to?
Oh my gosh. I'm usually listening to Pearl Jam or Led Zeppelin.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Perfect. That's right in line with me too. Yeah. So Pearl Jam. Well, we've talked to Led Zeppelin before. I think we'll find something from Pearl Jam.
Cause they won't allow it, right? Led Zeppelin.
Oh, they won't. No. Why is that?
Well, they had some history of not allowing people to use their music. And
oh, right.
I think that may have changed. But
May have changed. I'm not sure. No, we're just going to grab, I think I'll just grab a, that'll be a good test on Instagram. I'm not sure, but we'll just grab a YouTube video and throw in the show notes so anybody can grab that. So, but yeah, we'll put something from Pearl Jam and cool. Well, I think Brownie, this has been great today. We'll send everybody out to BlueRidgeBoatWorks.com. And if they want to check out this unique boat, we called it the Tesla boat. So we'll see what other people think, but I think it is a unique design. But I appreciate all your time today. We'll look forward to keeping in touch with you.
Hey, thank you so much, Dave.
That is a wrap. You can grab all of the show notes at wetflyswing.com. And please follow us on Instagram and share this episode out with someone you love. Please send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com, if you have any feedback or want us to put together an episode on this podcast for you. Check in anytime. I hope you enjoyed this podcast and would love to meet up with you on the water. We have new fly fishing schools going all year long and all around the country, so if you want to connect, let's do it right now. All right, time to get out of here. I hope you have a great evening. I hope you have a great morning or great afternoon wherever in the world you are. And I appreciate you for stopping by and checking out the show today. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.